I can't remember who's chairing the.
Andy, isn't it?
Andy. So I think Andy's coming forward.
How are we going to do this?
We just sit in the chair.
Should we just sit in the chair? Yeah. You got an ale?
Put the ale down now.
Yeah. Okay.
Pen.
Okay. I doubt that we've got many of the gentry and the middling sorts in front of us today, have we, Bill?
No.
So let's just go for this. All right. I haven't got a pen or a paper or anything, so. Let's just go for it, all right? Who wants to ask the first question? You, sir.
Do you think that pouch contains the first example of biological warfare? I've got a little bit more to say. There was very recently, I think on BBC 4, maybe BBC 2, an American historian, his name I can't recall, but he was talking about the later plays of Shakespeare, about Shakespeare's time, especially after James I came to the throne. And there was something in there about Shakespeare owning some land in Stratford, and that he had it enclosed in order to make more money. He had it enclosed and had sheep grazing on it, and I can't remember exactly, there was some letter found, I can't remember exactly what the words were in there, but he found it. There was a lot of we'd say it caused him a lot of grief, let's say. He was very upset at what happened about that. He'd gone through with it because he needed money, but it had resulted in throwing people off the land who had been cultivating. That's my contribution.
I think I saw something. It's a matter of being a track of the bits of Bob's up reading. I think I saw something about that and the suggestion that he'd had land certainly near where the protests were. One of the things in the article is that apparently this particular revolt, one of the notable things was that previous peasant revolts tended to be led by the yeomanry and the middling sort. The likes of Oliver Cromwell, who would later on lead to a much bigger rebellion. But this one was going on without those people involved, so this was also a slightly more serious. And the fact that Reynolds, Captain Pouch, was a tinker suggested it was much more of the more destitute end of the rural population. And obviously the yeomanry themselves were probably, if not implicated, certainly beneficiaries of enclosure.
Trevor?
I was going to say, Shakespeare is one of the great influences in literature and so on. Beethoven was one of the great geniuses of music composing. He was also a radical in that he was a man of the Enlightenment. He wrote a Coriolanus overture, and he was also a man who was going to write dedicated one of his symphonies to Napoleon until he discovered that Napoleon was going to crown himself, and he tore up the dedication. Now, the point I'm going to make was that if you listen to Beethoven's Coriolanus overture, this man was a radical in that sense, a bourgeois radical. You can hear Coriolanus and the crowd and the music. And if anybody ever wants to listen to classical music and see it telling the story, you can see hear the arrogance of Coriolanus against the crowd. And it's very interesting. You might need a guide to it. You definitely hear with the way the chords go and then stop. The crowd and Coriolanus. Nothing. I just make the point. This was a man who was also a genius similar to Beethoven, similar to Shakespeare, dealing with the same subject, and in his own way, but he was also in some ways more radical than Beethoven. I'll get it.
Yeah, some critics, I think there's some out there, have described Coriolanus as the first modern human, or this is their take on it. The first great individualist character.
Yeah.
So, in fact, we can properly use the term bourgeois correctly here. In terms of bourgeois development, he was of that sort, because he was repudiating all the mummery of the various crowd scenes of the ancient ritual, and wanted to stand up and be his own man and say, "I am self-made. I deserve this, and don't need all of this apparatus and your rights and disdaining of them. I mean, sometimes you can come across, depending on the production, I mean, that one, it comes across a bit adolescent occasionally. And then I think that's the angle that they've gone. I mean, I've seen other ones, and Stephen Burkoff having been a really shouty man, and others really cocky. It's capable of considering interpretation. I will have to hunt that up. That sounds very interesting. I didn't know about that one. Someone was asking earlier on if there was a Coriolanus opera, but
just an overture.
Just an overture. Well, I think everyone's somewhere.
I've never been to the play.
Okay. Any other issues, questions, points? Fraser?
The Tories have now come out with a new citizens test. And they've introduced Shakespeare again, and I understand Thatcher in her heyday tried to impose Shakespeare as well on the curriculum, and as you said, it poses radical questions but give conservative answers. I was just wondering if that is a kind of a subconscious thing in the Tory ideology, within the idea of citizenship and education in general.
Is it Tory idea? I think partly it's under the phrase of the Britain conquered its empire with Bible in one hand and Shakespeare in the other, and Shakespeare was seen as a sign of the superiority of the English or of the British, depending on the writer. And certainly he has come to be the gold standard of writing in a very almost a literal sense, to the extent that whenever you find a bad Shakespeare play, they try and explain that he didn't actually write that one. No one reads King John, and although the Globe did a version of Henry VIII, that's terrible plays. I think so. I think it's national chauvinism on their part. We've got Shakespeare. I don't think necessarily they've read it. Or if they do, I mean, again, the problem is that people read bits and they take them out, and when taken out of the context of the time of production, they become very distorted. I gave a talk a few years ago about The Merchant of Venice, and of course, everyone knows the "If you prick me, do I not bleed?" and "The quality of mercy will not be strained." And again, I quoted Hazlitt. Hazlitt was saying, well, nowadays everyone reads this and interprets, the idea of equality before the law. But he suspected, and he suspected rightly, that when Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice, every right-thinking person would have booed and hissed the evil Shylock. That would have been the natural reaction. And the idea of him being equal before the law would have been monstrous, because they didn't believe in equality before the law. But later on, when you have a more bourgeois society that does believe in equality before the law, they can pick out these lines and these radical questions that were being asked there, and they can ignore the conservative answer, which is, they find that there's a law in the Kingdom of Venice that says Jews can't shed Christian blood. If they do, they get killed, and that's the racist law saves the day. So that's the sort of thing. So they dig out, the "you happy few" and all the lines praising monarchy and the like, because they're there. But by the same token, there are other lines that are much more radical. I mean, certainly in Julius Caesar, when you read some of Cassius' stuff, you think, well, Caesar is the same as me, isn't he? He's a man as much as I am. Why should I bow to him? But of course, for Shakespeare, that's monstrous talk. For us, it's, good point.
Maybe I've misinterpreted anything, but if you can use the play to help piece together a model for protest that's sort of relevant from the early 17th century onwards, up to the modern day. I was just wondering how flexible that model is, and presumably any kind of protest that contributed to a revolutionary movement out of capitalism would have to break free of the model of protest which has been around for 300-400 years. So I was just wondering how we'd know when the model of protest for sort of the capitalist era, if you like, is changing or is evolving into a type of protest that will sort of break out of capitalism, if you see what I mean.
Well, firstly, I wouldn't say, maybe I wasn't clear, that it's a protest that's only been good since Shakespeare's time.
Yeah.
It's a model of protest that works for any city government or city polity, possibly any sort of polity, really, because protest has happened under all systems of society at all times. I suppose the point we would be looking at is the time when a demand is raised that can't be answered within the current system. There's some what Trotskyists would try and do. But the other point would be that you have the workers or the protesters have the power to enforce this demand and then find that it breaks. So, and then get to the point where they have to go, well, look, you know, we can't work within this current system. So I don't know if you can ever look for any protest movement that will turn into a revolutionary movement. I suspect it would be, we would know it because it would say, it would know itself to be a revolutionary protest movement, and its demands would be revolutionary demands. It wouldn't even concern itself with trying to play the language game, and it would say, we're not part of your body, we're not part of this this image you have of society, we're not Britons, we're not this, we have something very different that we have in mind. And I think the clarity, maybe, of the its demands would be the interesting thing. Certainly that would be the sign that it was revolution rather than just yet another protest.
Still.
Yeah, well, it would no longer be a protest. It would mean a movement that has got confidence and it wouldn't be making demands. It would be knowing that confidence means that it can now be in a position to take. So to actually demand things is to put yourself in a subservient role to power.
Mm-hmm. You could demand surrender.
I saw a couple of hands go up. Comrade at the back. And Craig's, did you put your hand up? Eddie?
No.
No.
Well, there's someone with that.
Yeah, there's a hand up here. Yeah, okay.
Power cannot be granted, it must be taken.
Bill, there's a man
it's
here.
Okay. Yeah. I remember doing Coriolanus at school years ago. The Volskys were his enemies, weren't they?
Volskys or Volscians, I've got another version where they pronounce it differently. And again, I think that no one necessarily knows if they were a real people. We don't know. There's no evidence of a Volscian people. But they would just have been another Latin tribe, like the Etruscans, if they existed at all.
This is one line to cut me to pieces of Volscian.
Yeah, that's. I think that's the end. He objects to being called a boy. He calls off the attack on Rome, and the Volscians kill him for it. It's a tragedy. He has to die.
Any other points? Would anybody like to say something, Danny Lambert, at the back? Yeah.
Yeah. You talked about the Midlands Uprising Bill, and they, you know, when they went and they tilled the land, the closed land, they was doing what the king would do if he was in that position. And you find the same kind of thing going on today, because you get a lot of, the protesters. Basically what we have at the moment is king capital. And you get a lot of people who think that what we have now is we have a perverted capitalism, being perverted by the corporations, and it's not being run properly. And essentially, what they're protesting about is that they want the system to run in a different way, not understanding that this is the only way it can run, and it's working perfectly well. I think this point has been raised and I go back to what I said with the Glasgow branch, showing up black cards saying this protest is useless. In that what people are trying to do is they're trying to get their rulers, their kings or whatever, or the system, to change in their interest. And it's never going to happen. And the only real way to make a difference is not to protest, not to demand reforms, but to organise, to abolish the system that oppresses us.
Sir, yeah.
Going back to what Mike was suggested, actually, aside of two kinds of process, I mean, one gets the image of a kind of, if you see the society as a kind of body and a kind of cosmological idea of the world, as it were, there's things like that, But with the rise of capitalism and the Enlightenment, you get a very different vision of what the social life is about. Instead of society being an organic kind of static thing, you've got the idea of social life as being a process. And you get it with Ferguson and people in the Scottish Enlightenment, of course, and capitalism implies that. Therefore, when the protest in the second situation is a very different, it's a process towards, if you want to change in the world, you're thinking of a future. You know, not purely, I'm not thinking of a linear thing, you know, this is how Marxism is using, but seeing history and social life as a process rather than as a cosmological, organic whole, as it were, which is kind of created by God or whoever, but is unchanging, to an idea of social life and history as being a process. And of course, protesting in that second, the kind of the modern era, because often modernity is actually more or less defined in a kind of terms of a historical consciousness. In that thing, protest then is actually thinking of having an image that actually, as was talked about this afternoon, you know, the image is of a future kind of society. You get what I mean?
Yes, I think there's a... I'm trying to remember, it's been a whilst I've played with these. I think there's some Foucauldians... Sorry for mentioning Foucault. Talk about, because Foucault's big idea is power, and it defines you. And you have all various intersecting discourses that say you are what you are. And there's some suggestion that it goes from this sort of like definition to a more process space, where you're not just what you are; you are going on from being an infant to an adolescent to an adult to an old age pensioner, and that you're controlled through various institutions at these various stages. And passed from one to another throughout your life, and that's the various different ways in which power manifests itself in modern society, rather than as a kind of much more static thing. I mean, that was the whole point of discipline and punish, which was that, like we say here, that back then it was the spectacular mutilation of the body was the way in which they maintained control. And you know they quartered the corpses of a few of the rebels and showed the quartered corpse of a man and said, "Well, it's up to you. If you rise up." And of course that worked in a fairly disparate society we had, but in a much more compacted city-based society, of course that doesn't work. You can't rule by that sort of terror. So you need the panopticon and the sort of like the social control through a policing mechanism and through various bureaucracies. Mm.
Sort of structuralist, structuralism, which is a sort of individuated sort of mechanism for controlling society. I think Comrade Buick wants to make a point.
I mean, there hasn't been any socialist revolution, but there's been a number of revolutions since 1607. I mean, surely there is a difference between people protesting and saying, "This is what we want the king to do, this is what the king would have done." And what happened a few years later, when you actually chop off the head of the king, or in America you kick out the ruler, or in France you kill him, and in, you know, same thing happens in Russia. So I mean, to come back to somebody's point over here, there must be a difference between protesting, you know, like saying that this is what the king would have done, or this is what the Tsar would have done, or something, and actually overthrowing the king.
Oh yeah, I'd certainly say that yes, there's definitely difference. And of course, there's been lots of revolutions, and the fact that there's now an entire Routledge encyclopedia of revolution in five volumes. So that it's that commonplace that, you know, that nowadays they have to have their own colour code. And I suppose now soon they'll run out of colours and they'll have to have barcodes or something. Mm-hmm. The barcoded revolutions. But they're certainly different. Well, I mean, partly the first instance is that the king has to fail. So the king, they make the demand, and then the king doesn't supply the demand, and they go, "Well, we'll do it ourselves," or "We have to go and capture the king." And of course, the early modern idea was that the king is badly advised. So if we go to the king and we tell him how things really stand and kill his advisers and put our own advisers in, then we will control the king. And I suppose, in a way, that's our view, that's more or less what we say will happen. We the state is badly used, we will take over the state and use it for our own ends, you know. So I said there was a difference in our days between protesting to the state saying, dear government, please do this, and we're coming to get you government, we're taking over and becoming the government ourselves. And I think I've never been able to trace the source of this, but I think E.P. Thompson made the distinction between plebeian and proletarian politics. And I think the only way I can understand this is plebeian politics is, you know, we almighty patricians, we beseech you, grant us our demands, and proletarian politics says, well, we can make it ourselves.
Good. Trevor, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Through the chair, if you don't mind. Okay.
It's rather extraordinary that we have a 5-volume book on revolution, don't know how many revolutions are mentioned there, but it can't be revolutions in the sense of changing social mode of production. They must be coup d'etats and all the sort of, you know, battles between dynasties and maybe small peasant revolts and things, but they, would we consider them revolutions in the sense of, we think in terms of changing, you know, modes of production, surely not that number. I mean, maybe the ones we see in the Arab Spring as a kind of revolution, like the 1848-49 revolution, we take the French and those things, the English, a few others, but I can't, unless you've filled out the recent capitalistically related revolutions. If you listed them, it's a Wikipedia that size, they couldn't occupy 5 volumes.
Well, I think the volumes also include biographies of the various leading actors. So when you think of all the prominent Bolsheviks, you'd have to list all the prominent French revolutionaries, you'd have to list. You start to work towards them. But then, it's the Carnation Revolution, the Czechoslovakian uprising, the Prague Spring, the Hungarian uprising. You know, it's not a Marxist encyclopedia of revolution. It's what the Routledge encyclopedists call revolution.
Okay. Does anybody else want to make a point, or are we going to relax and have a good evening? We've entertained by the inscrutable Bill Martin, and I think we should put our hands together to just say thank you to Comrade Martin for what I would say is a very thought-provoking, quite interesting talk. And, thank you, Bill.
Thank you. I was hoping for a short session because I was thinking if enough people are interested, we could just stick the film on. It's 2 hours, which is a bit of a but if anyone wants to watch it, it's in the machine there and I could turn it on.